I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. You'd be surprised at the number of famous performers who have had stage fright. Laurence Olivier freaked out playing Othello. Michael Gambon was taken to the hospital because of his stage fright symptoms. Carly Simon is notoriously anxious about performing. Pianist Vladimir Horowitz stopped performing for a dozen years because of stage fright. Baseball player Steve Sachs couldn't find the strike zone because of performance anxiety. And pop star Adele says she has vomited before performances because of her anxiety attacks. Our guest Sarah Solovich was so nervous about performing in public that she gave up a promising career as a pianist. She writes about performance anxiety in her book, Playing Scared, A History and Memoir About Stage Fright. She's a journalist, in fact, spent a number of years at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and she joins us on Radio Times. And Sarah Solovich, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hello, and thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And also with us is Franklin Schneier. He's a special lecturer in psychiatry, also professor emeritus at Columbia University Medical Center, and a research scientist in the Anxiety Disorders Clinic at New York State Psychiatric Institute. And Franklin Schneier, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Sarah, let me begin with you. Do you have any stage fright right now, talking about your stage fright?
No, my anxiety is so pianophobic. It's kind of weird. I'm able to get up and talk before people and perform in various other contexts, but put me in front of a piano and I have a meltdown.
So what does your stage fright, what does that feel like to you when you're in front of a piano with a thought that you're going to perform in public?
Well, in the past, what typically would happen was my hands would start to sweat and just become so wet that I would start to slip, my fingers would slip and slide across the keys. And my fingers would, be shaking and trembling uncontrollably. And then my feet would also tremble so they couldn't hold down the pedals and my knees would knock. And I would lose my ability to focus and remember music that I had memorized, just perfectly at home or at my lesson.
And what was going on inside your head? What were you saying, or what are you saying to yourself under these circumstances?
It's a lot of negative thinking, or at least it was before I started to tackle this problem in a really concerted way. I'm telling myself a lot that I'm an idiot. Sometimes, when I start to, in periods where I'm playing well, I'm thinking, oh, now you're doing really well. And I kind of shift back and forth, but I've lost focus. And that's really the killer.
Well, let me turn to you, Frank. How should we understand stage fright? And perhaps there's even a psychiatric definition of stage fright.
Stage fright is part of a broader kind of fears about performance in general. And it's one of the most common fears in the general population. About a third of the population will report, for example, having significant fears of public speaking. But only a smaller percentage, maybe 5%, really report that their lives are really impaired by it, because most people can avoid that. If your profession as a performer, obviously you can't, and it becomes a much more important issue. We understand performance anxiety is really starting in the brain, and that's where the anxiety signal starts in a part of the brain called the amygdala. And activation of that part of the brain sets off a whole cascade of physiological reactions. Adrenaline increases throughout the body. So it goes to the muscles and causes tremor. It goes to the heart and causes the heart to beat more rapidly. And when it's severe, it's really the body preparing itself for a fight or flight situation, as if you're being, attacked by a tiger. Even though the situation is not one in which either fleeing or fighting would be a good solution. So that's why it's very disruptive in a performance situation.
And are there certain kinds of people or even personality types? I'm thinking of people that might be shy or maybe even perfectionistic that are at risk for, if not stage fright, certainly performance anxiety?
Well, people who have social anxiety in general who are shy tend to also have performance anxiety. And sometimes those people, if it's severe, have a diagnosis of social anxiety disorder. But then the subset of people, really are fine in informal social situations, socializing with people, meeting people, talking informally. But for them, it's the performance situation that's problematic. And it may be across a variety of performance situations where people feel like all eyes are upon them, where they're being evaluated. Or like for Sarah, it may be very focused on one particular situation that has a special significance or meaning for them.
In fact, Sarah, you write something in your book that I scribbled down because I thought it was such an interesting description of stage fright, the act of mutiny by the mind against the body. Can you flesh that out for us?
Well, I know that there are times that I've gone, you know, to sit down at the piano and felt, composed and in control, and that there was no problem at all, and I would raise my fingers above the keys, and suddenly, you know, as I played that first chord, everything would fall apart. And it was almost as if, you know, I was just self-sabotaging without, you know, having any control over it. And it just seemed so irrational, and my body, which knew and knows the music so well, was unable to assert itself. Mm. So, yeah, I did feel like my mind was really controlling, you know, or it just became a feedback loop. And, you know, vice versa, my body controlled my mind as well.
Well, and sounds, Frank, too, using Sarah's description as a kind of extreme self-consciousness. I mean, this sort of inability, especially in a performance, to sort of get out of one's way.
Yeah, the key thing a performer needs to be focusing on is to focus on the task at hand, to focus on the performance, on communicating with the audience. And when these severe symptoms become the focus of attention, either internal focus, I'm focusing on my body, my heart's pounding, I'm shaking, are people going to notice it, focusing on others' reactions, you can't focus on your performance and focus on others at the same time.
Sarah, you had a teacher, or perhaps even have a teacher, who came up with a really, in helping you deal with your stage fright, came up with a really novel idea. And this was to have you practice the piano in public, in fact, to practice at an airport near the baggage claim section of the airport. Obviously, a very public place where people are coming and going. What was the thinking behind that, and how did that influence your so-called performance in public?
Yes, that was my teacher, and still is my teacher, Ellen Chen. Early on, when I first went to her, one of the first things she told me was that she was taking some of her younger students to the airport, and she wanted me to accompany them. And I just thought it sounded ridiculous at the time, but she was going to have a little recital at the airport on this, you know, kind of rinky-dink, tinny-sounding piano just outside the baggage claim area of the Southwest Terminal in San Jose. And we just sat down and, you know, played through our pieces and, you know, kind of one by one. And the first time I was absolutely terrified and had all the symptoms. And then, you know, a few other people played. And then it was I thought it was time to go. And instead, it was just my turn to play it again. And we did it over and over again. So that by the fourth or fifth time, it was just starting to seem boring and routine. And I was able to relax and finally just kind of like breathe and feel that this was kind of a normal thing. It was almost like being in your own living room. And I realized that nobody cared if I made a mistake. Nobody was evaluating me because, in fact, so much of my fear, I think, was kind of instilled, you know, as a young person with knowing that I was always being evaluated when I would be entered into these, you know, I'd play in these music festivals starting at about the age of 11 years old. And it was very clearly evaluative and competitive, and there was a judge scribbling notes and giving awards to everybody who played. So I started going to the airport on a regular basis just by myself after this so-called recital. And I would go every couple weeks maybe, and just lay all my music out on the rack and start playing for half an hour or so. And it became a routine of mine, another kind of practice.
And would people come in over and listen to you directly play, or were you more kind of background music?
Oh, for the most part, I was background music. I think that most people didn't pay any attention to me, and that was perfect. It was exactly what I wanted. People were just getting, everybody's going somewhere or leaving and, can't wait to, they've got their tasks at hand, and I think most people didn't even see me. But then there were people occasionally who had stuff to do they were just waiting for a flight, and they would sit down or waiting for somebody to pick them up from the airport. So they would sit down. There were chairs, kind of encircling the piano, and the sky caps sometimes would gather with their lunches and their coffee, and they would sit and listen and occasionally applaud me as I was, when I left. But I found the whole thing very freeing.
Well, let me get a response from you, Frank. I mean, what do you think of that as a approach to dealing with stage fright?
Well, what Sarah did is like the single most important part of overcoming stage fright or any phobia, and technically it's called exposure. What happens with people with a severe anxiety situation is that they tend to avoid the situation naturally. Avoidance, unfortunately, allows the fear to grow. You don't have an opportunity to disprove it. And it becomes more and more difficult to conquer. So the most effective approach has to incorporate some kind of usually a gradual exposure to what you fear. And going to the airport and taking it a step further than the normal thing, like going to the airport, is really a powerful way of strengthening that learning that it's a safe thing to do. For most people, they're not going to start there. They're going to start with some easier situations, really just maybe even just imagining themselves in the situation in front of the mirror while they're practicing, and then finding some less stressful situations and gradually building up to situations that they normally wouldn't even think of doing.
And we're almost up in a break here. Sarah talks about the sort of non-judgmental audience, that there were the people at the airport obviously mostly were coming and going, catching planes, catching a taxi to go somewhere. Is that helpful, Frank?
It's a great way to transition into those other more challenging situations. It sounds like for Sarah, the critical thing was the thought about that audience judging her. So by being in a place where there was a non-judgmental audience that she could really believe, wasn't there to evaluate her, it got her to experience playing in public, not having that surge of anxiety, and sounds like that was a breakthrough.
Well, we are talking about stage fright, performance anxiety. That's Franklin Schneier. Also with us, Sarah Solovich. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We want you to join the conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Does this sound like you? You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Again, we're talking about stage fright, about performance anxiety, about the extreme nervousness that people often feel when they're in front of a large audience, perhaps feeling those sweaty palms, the shaky hands, the quavering voice. Sarah Solovich writes about all of this in her new book. It's called Playing Scared, A History and Memoir of Stage Fright. She's a former reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and has been describing the kind of stage fright that she has felt for really decades as a pianist. Also with us, Franklin Schneier, professor emeritus at Columbia University Medical Center, research scientist in the Anxiety Disorders Clinic at New York State Psychiatric Institute. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Frank, I want to just sort of pick up on what Sarah was describing about playing in the baggage claim terminal of the airport. I think that's sort of a brilliant thing. But is it that over time you sort of teach yourself, I can do this, I can do this without freaking out. I can do this without my palms getting sweaty. I can do this without being judged by others?
Well, the natural reaction to a performance stressful situation is that someone experiences some activation of their nervous system. They feel They feel their heart beating more strongly. They feel muscle tension. And once they get into the performance, that tends to abate. It tends to get less. They focus on what they're doing, and they get confidence that way. Now, for some people, though, it doesn't diminish that way. It might be because they have some genetic basis for their nervous system being more activated and persisting more easily, or it might be that they have some beliefs or negative thoughts that are feeding into the fear and not letting it diminish by, you know, the thoughts that people are judging her, that it's going to be a disaster and things like that maintain it. So by getting into a situation where either you don't have some of those thoughts because of the nature of the situation, people aren't going to be judging her so much in this situation at the airport because they're not really there to even listen to her, or by going into the situation with certain tools that you've prepared, like having practiced some ways of thinking about the situation that might be helpful. So instead of focusing on everybody's judging me, to really focus on the idea people might enjoy some of the music I'm playing, or that, you know, I have something to communicate to people, or by going into the situation with some other tools, like some relaxation breathing exercises that I can do if I feel anxious, or by channeling that anxiety into my performance. That way one can have a successful experience and then turn around that vicious cycle of fear avoidance into a cycle of success, confidence, and more success with future performances.
And Sarah, you talked to a lot of people actually about this book, some of them talking about the importance of breathing that Frank just mentioned, mindfulness, yoga, EMDR, cognitive behavior therapy. Was there one that seemed to be more helpful to you than another?
Well, certainly yoga was really instrumental because it gave me a tool to work both on my breathing but also on my focus, which was so important for me to kind of channel myself and not think about, you know, just to pay attention to the task at hand rather than to just constantly get diverted and let my nerves kind of govern what was going on in my, you know, in my head and then in my body. But I guess the most important thing was, you know, actually doing it, because before this happened, I mean, I would just look for every opportunity to avoid playing, even just in front of one or two people. And when I first set myself up, you know, for the goal of giving a concert, to me it was like a one-time thing. It was a make-or-break situation. And if I had continued on that path, I would have been setting myself up for a certain failure. So in addition to the airport, I also set up a lot of small performances, which I called soirees, and I would typically invite 8 or 10 people over to my house, you know, on a weekend evening, and I'd perform, you know, 2 or 3 pieces for them. And sometimes, you know, I would play these pieces 2 or 3 times, you know, until I really felt comfortable. And then I'd, you know, like serve them wine and dessert. But really, they were doing me a great service by sitting there and just listening to it. And I think this is something that a lot of musicians and probably other kinds of performers do too. You know, they don't just take a concert out on the road and play it at Carnegie Hall, for instance. Horowitz, when he, you know, came back from a 12-year hiatus of not playing at all, would just play before a lot of, you know, like small little groups of people in their living rooms. And musicians do that all the time before they go and perform one large, you know, concert. They try it out many, many times. So that was really important to me.
Well, it's interesting, Frank. It's sort of almost like rebranding. Instead of calling it a concert, it's called a soiree. I mean, these are the sort of, I guess, almost like tricks you can play on yourself to tamp down some of that anxiety.
Yeah, the way you think about the situation can very much affect the way your body's reacting to it. And so in a way they're tricks, but they have to be tricks you really believe, because it's not enough to just tell yourself, I'm not going to be anxious, or that it doesn't matter. You have to really dig down into what am I afraid of, and then really challenge that. You know, what's the worst that could happen? Maybe someone won't like my performance. Is that the end of the world?
Uh-huh.
And through that kind of process, come to some way of thinking about it that you can believe, but that directs you away from the anxiety.
I heard you utter something, Sarah. Go ahead.
Oh, I was thinking of a Harvard Business School study in the last couple of years, which talked precisely to that. They called it rebranding your fear. And before, you know, you get up and speak publicly or act or give a performance, instead of telling yourself, I'm really nervous, you'd say, I'm really excited.
Right.
So just that change in language can be very powerful.
Because, Frank, we have a third guest waiting in the wings here. I want to get her on because sometimes anxiety and excitement can be experienced, at least by the body, as the same kind of thing.
Absolutely. The physiology is quite overlapping. And, in fact, if you measure people's physiological responses to performance, so you put on some electrodes, you measure their heart rate, you measure their breathing, and you look at people who are anxious performers and non-anxious performers, there aren't a whole lot of differences. There's a little bit more activation in the people who are anxious overall, but there's a lot of overlap. And so it really highlights how a lot of this is the way people are interpreting their physiological response and not necessarily that it's purely a difference in the way their body's reacting.
And that's a psychiatrist, Franklin Schneier, joining us along with Sarah Solovich. She's written a book called Playing Scared, A History and Memoir of Stage Fright. We are talking about stage fright, performance anxiety. Looking for comments. I see them coming in at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Joining us now is Jen Wassner. She's lead singer, multi-instrumentalist, and songwriter for Y Oak and Flock of Dimes. And Jen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. So how long have you been performing?
Gosh, I've probably been performing since I was about 15 years old, so about 15 years now, since I was really young. And it's interesting because my experience with stage fright has been relatively recent. I never really dealt with it very much. I was always a very casual, very comfortable person on the stage. And for, you know, at least the past maybe 5 or 6 years, I've been touring and performing as my main source of income and my job, and done it a lot. And I think for most people, they tend to maybe get a little bit more comfortable with themselves
mm-hmm.
when they do it so much and it becomes a little bit like second nature. But for me, I've actually sort of had, ironically enough, like a total reversal of that, and I've developed more and more anxiety as I've toured and performed more.
And why do you think that is, Jen? I mean, what do you think is at the root of that?
My theory about it is that, and I guess that it all sort of stems from some experiences that I've had, having certain performances that I, in my mind, consider to be in the moment, become documented and released for public consumption, kind of without my awareness. And, you know, at this point, when you're playing shows for people, it's not really just for the people who are in the room. And everyone's got a cell phone. Everyone's documenting everything that's happening all the time. And there's videos and there's Instagrams and there's tweets going out all the time. And so, you know, if I'm having a really fun night, and maybe I've had a couple drinks and I want to play a song that I've never played before and see how it goes. You know, it'd be one thing to do that for 500 people. It's another thing entirely to, you know, find out the next day that that song has been recorded and released to, you know, anyone who wants to listen to it on the internet. So I think, and that doesn't necessarily always happen, but I think just sort of an increased awareness of the fact that can happen, and that you're being observed by an audience outside of the audience that's just the one that you had, is a little bit frightening to me. So I think that's probably why I've developed increased anxiety.
Well, Jen, hold on 1 second, because I do want to give Frank and also Sarah a chance to respond to this. And Frank, what she's really describing it is, or describing for her particular stage fright, is seems like it's internet related. And we know how nasty and mean the internet can be, and how judgmental the internet is when, you know, weighing in on a particular person's performance. Any thoughts about the internet and stage fright?
Well, I think people respond to that differently. Obviously, in this case, that made the situation a lot more scary and kind of raised the stakes. But I'm not sure that everyone would interpret it, that situation the same way necessarily. Sometimes when things are like much more available and it may, you know, be going to people who are much more forgiving of the performances, who aren't going to be as critical as the core audience.
Like fans,
some
for
people,
instance.
Yeah, for some people that might not evoke that same thing. And, you know, one might try to deal with that by thinking about that worst-case scenario. What, you know, what if it did go viral and it wasn't a great performance? How bad would that be? Mm. Or how likely is that to happen?
Jen, does it make you more, I mean, are you more self-conscious when you're performing, when you're on stage? Do you have more nervousness about going out and doing what you do?
Of late, yes, because I do think I feel a little bit more observed and scrutinized than I ever really felt when I was younger. But I do think that, I mean, hearing, you know, the suggestion of, like, imagining the worst-case scenario is actually really on point. It's been really helpful for me in the past, because I think in many instances, the worst case scenario has actually happened for
right,
me.
Exactly. Congratulations on that, by the way.
Yeah, no, pretty much I've had a few different times where the worst thing that could possibly happen pretty much just happened. And the funny thing that people always say, I mean, for us, my bandmate and I, we work really, really hard. We're just a two-piece band, and so we work really hard to really maximize what we're capable of on the stage. And so when things don't go well at your technical reasons, we get really, really upset about it because we feel like it's inhibiting our ability to, you know, share our songs the way we want them to be heard.
Sure.
But for other people, sometimes that means a special, unique experience seeing a performance that has never happened and will never happen again. And so, you know, for us, that's the worst case scenario. But, you know, we've been frequently surprised by how people have responded to our own worst-case scenarios, and sometimes it's really not as bad as you think it's going to be.
Well, that's a great lesson. And Sarah, anything, we have to say goodbye to Jen so we can get some callers in. Sarah, anything you want to say in response to what we've been talking about?
Well, what struck me in my reporting around this was that so many of us are really fragile, and oftentimes one thing was said, or at least the memory of, you know, one thing, one incident, and that was the trigger that just kind of set off of, you know, like years of stage fright. I'm thinking in particular of Tom Durkin, who's the horse racing announcer for the Preakness. And soon after he was named to, you know, or signed with NBC, some reporter, a sports reporter, asked him, "What's it like to be one easy mistake away from being a national joke?" And that just kind of set him off. And suddenly, you know, he just developed this really bad case of anxiety that ultimately led to his walking away from this, you know, multi-million dollar contract because he just couldn't deal with this uncertainty. So, yeah, I think there are a lot of us in the closet, and a lot of us have been affected by sometimes just one incident.
Well, Jen, I hate to sort of leave on that note, and I wish you the best in your performing career. And thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Jen Wassner, lead singer, multi-instrumentalist, and songwriter for Y Oak and Flock of Dimes. We are continuing our conversation talking about performance anxiety, about stage fright. Brian has been hanging on very patiently from Pottstown. Let me get him to join the conversation. Hi, Brian. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I am a music student down at Peabody, but I'm home for the summer.
Yes.
In Baltimore.
Yes.
And I was just wondering if there's an explanation for the fact that I do not usually have stage fright problems when I perform now, but when I do something like easy, like make a phone call or do other things like that, I do get some anxiety. I just wondered if there's any sort of explanation for that kind of situational anxiety.
Well, and Brian, since you just made a phone call to a radio show, are you obviously overcome whatever anxiety you had?
Indeed, a little bit.
Well, let me see if Frank can help you out. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. I mean, Frank, it's interesting, and I think Sarah has this as well, which is a very sort of specific activity, I guess, that is frightening or scary.
Yeah, well, sometimes these kinds of fears stay focused on one particular thing, like the music performance or Sarah. And for other people, they do shift around. These sounds like they're all the fears that Brian's describing are in the realm of kind of being evaluated by other people. And, it can be very subtle things that we don't quite know what is causing one to be more prominent than another at any one point. But it's not uncommon for a variety of these fears to crop up in the same general area.
And Frank, do you agree with Sarah that many of us are fragile and that a hurtful or painful comment can take us down?
Well, I think we're both fragile but also resilient. But, you know, I think that idea that one bad anxiety reaction to one comment, for example, can have profound effects, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, our brains are really wired to learn from dangerous situations to avoid them. So an anxiety reaction in a performance or wherever is a powerful learning experience, and it really the memory of that is quite strong. And so one memory of a panic attack in a performance will outweigh many positive experiences of doing well in a performance. And it takes a number of positive experiences to overlay new memories over that fear memory.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Franklin Schneier about anxiety and performance anxiety, stage fright. He's research scientist in the Anxiety Disorders Clinic at New York State Psychiatric Institute. Sarah Solovich with us as well, author of a book called Playing Scared, A History and Memoir of Stage Fright. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Sarah Solovich and Franklin Schneier about the roots of performance anxiety, about stage fright, learning how to cope with it. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Sarah, one of the things, and I do want to get to our callers, we have some comments as well, but you write about beta blockers and did a fair amount of reporting on, I guess, how common it is in some fields for performers to use some form of a beta blocker. What did you find?
Well, it's especially common among symphony musicians. It's been estimated that up to 30% of them take propranolol, which is, you know, the main beta blocker prescribed for performance anxiety. And many people have told me that's really a lowball estimate.
Wow.
Some musicians have told me that, you know, we all take them, at least in specific circumstances. For instance, you know, auditions. That's, you can just basically assume that everyone is on a beta blocker in that kind of environment. I found that they were both well-used and also kind of a taboo subject. A lot of musicians who I reached out to talk to about it wouldn't talk to me, or they would only talk to me off the record. It's so controversial, and I'm not really sure why that is, because, you know, in an age where marijuana is so ubiquitous, you can hardly take a walk, at least in my hometown, without inhaling. And yet, you know, beta blocker, which is one of the most widely prescribed medications in the world, is seen as something that, you know,
Is it like cheating somehow?
Yeah, it's kind of like a cheat, exactly. I mean, I once had a teacher pull me aside. Not my current teacher, but a teacher pull me aside and say, "Are you on that drug?"
Oh, wow.
You know, as if there is something really shameful about it.
And you tried it, Sarah, yes?
Yeah, I tried it. And I felt that it was just another tool that helped me become inured to the, you know, to the whole activity of performing. It helped me kind of create a number of good memories, you know, around performing after a lifetime of having bad memories about it. And And so as I kind of moved through this year, I could look back and think, well, I didn't fall apart then, and I did well here, and I could start to focus on those, and it just created, it bolstered me. And eventually, I mean, the amount was so small, but by the end I was only taking half a pill, which was 5 milligrams, which is a pretty small dose.
Frank, do you have a position on beta blockers and performance anxiety?
Yeah, so well, beta blockers, so they're a medication that is approved for use for high blood pressure, some other cardiac conditions, and they are often used off-label for performance anxiety. And what they do is that they block the effects of adrenaline on the different organs of the body. So the adrenaline is still circulating, but it blocks its effect of the heart, so it doesn't speed up the heart rate like it normally would. It blocks its effect on the muscles so that the people don't develop the tremor that they normally would. And so by reducing the physical symptoms for some people, it can dramatically improve their ability to focus on the task at hand instead of focusing on the fact that their heart is pounding. But there are a couple of caveats. One is that in at least one study of musicians, they gave beta blockers to both anxious and non-anxious musicians during an audition with blind observers. And what they found was that the anxious performers' performance clearly improved with the beta blockers, but the non-anxious musicians didn't improve, and in fact, some of them showed a fall off in their performance, as if perhaps they weren't able to have the same passion come forth when they were on beta blockers. So they're probably, you know, not helpful for everybody. And I think unlike performance-enhancing drugs like steroids, which you know will make anybody more muscular, beta blockers really are more targeted to help people who have high levels of anxiety to be more normal, as opposed to helping people who are performing normally to become super performers. So in that way, I think that they're not a typical kind of performance-enhancing drug as much as a drug that's treating a problem. But the other concern with beta blockers is that if they work well, it's a mixed blessing because people do become psychologically dependent on them in the sense that they may feel like they need that every time they give a performance. And if that takes the place of the other kind of learning process of feeling like they have some tools to cope with it, it may leave them feeling psychologically dependent so that they have to give an impromptu performance and they don't have it in their pocket, that may be even more of a crisis.
Let me get
to... I've heard of that.
You've heard of that. Yes.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. Let me get Carmel from Lansdale to join the conversation. Hi, Carmel. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank you. I love the show.
Great.
I learned to speak publicly by virtue of my church. We're taught as young children from the age of 3 onward to get up in front of a group and give, you know, a minute and more minutes as you get older. It's not a problem. Huh? I can sit up and speak on anything you want me that I have knowledge of and not have a problem.
And that's just because it sounds like you've been doing it pretty much, Carmel, your entire life.
From the age of 3 onward, and I'm middle aged now.
Well, Frank, there's something to be said for, if not practice, certainly just doing something over and over again. It takes away some of the fear, the sting.
Yeah, I think it's a great thing for parents to have, you know, look for opportunities for their kids to get some practice, especially if they're anxious. The natural tendency can be to protect a child who's feeling anxious, but that can be detrimental in the long run, as opposed to trying to find some opportunities that are not so stressful with a friendly audience that can build up confidence.
You know, Sarah, I want to quote something from your book and the way you write about your early years as a pianist. And it sounds like you had a lot of talent, probably still do, but that your mother was very invested in you being a pianist and probably, mm-hmm. you know, the best in the world. And you were talking with someone who, and I'm quoting here, speculated that your performance anxiety served as an important, maybe even restorative function. It was my body's protest against something I was otherwise powerless to protest. If, as an adolescent, I couldn't refuse my mother's expectations and stop entering those endless competitions, my body would speak up on my behalf. The idea that your anxiety was saying, I don't want to do this, and eventually, I guess, was your ticket or your way out of being a public performer.
Yeah, I found that to be a very powerful insight. But, you know, a little stage fright is a good thing, as long as you can control it. It keeps you on your toes, and it gives you passion. And it, you know, when I, you know, get up on, you know, and talk on the radio, for instance, right now, or I'm getting up to, you know, before a group of people, of course I have some butterflies in my stomach, but I kind of enjoy that. It lets me know that I'm excited and that this is a special situation. It's different from sitting at a cafe and shooting the breeze with a friend.
Well, and you also describe this sort of build up. I don't want to use that word because it might make you nervous, but this build up to your 60th birthday and you wanted to give a performance. You invited about 50 people. Sounds like most of them were your friends, and it lasted for about an hour. Mm-hmm. You did okay. You made a couple little mistakes, but you also felt like you really did connect with the audience. Has that opened a door for you for further performances, or was that really what you wanted to do and that's perfectly fine with you?
Well, actually, when I began the process, I thought that's all I would do, that it would just come to, you know, kind of a head. I would do it one time. I would grit my teeth and get through it without making a mistake. And I discovered kind of halfway through the year that my relationship to music changed, and my relationship even to standing up and communicating with people had all, it just all started to kind of flow into, you know, different things. And I, not that I enjoy it. I can't say I really
enjoy it. You don't enjoy it.
No, but there are moments in it that I enjoy, and I do love communicating it, and I love the music, and I feel that it's really, at least it's important to me to take it outside of myself and not to just be playing, you know, behind closed doors, that it's about taking it before to other people and keeping it alive. So, yes, I am still continuing to perform, not in huge ways, but in, you know, groups of, you know, fairly significant, you know, groups of people.
Well, good for you. Let me get Joel from Mount Airy to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Joel. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to ask your guest, Dr. Snyder or Ms. Solovich, if they have insights or experiences about using visualization as a means to overcome stage fright or to achieve a successful performance or outcome.
Joel, let me toss that to Frank and see what he has to say, the use of visualization.
Yeah, I think visualization can be one tool in developing a plan of exposure or not avoiding the situation. So, especially for people who have a lot of fear, where even just going into the situation, a milder performance situation, would be difficult. Starting out with imagining the situation, imagining the fear, but imagining yourself working through it successfully, and then that can be another tool that you can apply when you're actually in a performance situation.
I mean, I've heard of people saying, you know, if they're sort of fearful that the audience is going to be a harsh critic, that you sort of imagine the whole audience in their underwear or something, and then
that's what my teacher used to tell me when I was a child. Actually,
did that work, Sarah?
At all.
Did not work at all.
No, I thought it was a horrible thing. Or she would say, I even heard I'm naked. Imagine them naked,
right?
Which probably scared me more than anything else. I didn't find that at all helpful. But occasionally, I remember even as a young person, I would also visualize when I was practicing. Sometimes I would imagine that I was playing before an audience, and sometimes I would imagine that it was a competitive audience and that I would be in this situation, and I would imagine the adjudicator sitting in the aisle and scribbling notes and thinking, you know, if I just can play through this and feel, you know, the anxiety through this visualization, then I'll be able to take it, you know, live. And I've since changed my thinking about this. I don't really do that kind of visualization anymore. What I really practice when I'm practicing is total focus.
Which is obviously very different. Frank, do you want to weigh in on that at all?
Yes, I think that's a great approach. And, the idea of thinking about people being naked in the audience while amusing It doesn't really get to the heart of what interfering with the performance. So, I mean, that's either visualizations that help like Sarah suggested at first, thinking about what are your fears, you know, imagining yourself having them yet overcoming them, that works for some people, or focusing on the task at hand.
Let me see what Helen from, looks like Lehigh Valley has to say. And Helen, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I retrained starting in 1995 using music learning theory, which is taught at Temple University. And that made it possible for me to perform from memory without using the music, which I hadn't been able to do before.
And you're a professional violinist, right, Helen?
I'm a professional violinist and teacher, right. So I changed everything starting in 1995, and I would say that it has paid off enormously.
And you're saying you're retrained, so you don't look at the music at all? You memorize it? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's the way I learn things initially that makes a difference in how I perform in the end. In other words, it's my first encounter with the music that makes a difference.
Ah, well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Does that sort of fit with your thinking, Frank, which is sort of our first experience with something can color how we experience it in the future?
I'm sure that is one factor that could be important for some people.
I also had a question about, and this is we're almost out of time here, Frank, about the idea of tricks that people use, maybe a lucky rabbit's foot or some kind of magical thinking that people can do, put something on a piano that makes them feel good. Is that helpful? Is that kind of gimmicky?
Tricks like that, I think, can sometimes work for people, but they can also backfire because they're not really based on any new learning or a different way of perceiving the situation. And so if they don't work, then suddenly their magic is gone, and then you're back to square one, whereas kind of approach that's more directed towards really dealing with what's underlying the problem might give you a more stable, kind of sustainable solution.
Sarah, we have to say goodbye. Any final words before we do that?
Well, I think that what I developed was just this whole toolbox, you know, full of tricks. And there were so many, and I used these little totems, you know, a photograph of a loved one that I put on the piano, and, you know, the visualization and the focus and the many, you know, lead-up kinds of concerts that I gave. And I just think that there are all kinds of things that, you know, just give you a sense of confidence and, you know, as you move into this, and it's really part of the human condition. We all really have this fear to one degree or another, and we have to learn to, you know, address it kind of individually.
Well, on that note, Sarah Solovich, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
We did as well. And the book is called Playing Scared, A History and Memoir of Stage Fright. And Franklin Schneier, thank you for joining us as well.
Oh, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Research scientist in the Anxiety Disorders Clinic at New York State Psychiatric Institute. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we're closing things out with Chic. This is Stage Fright from their 1981 album, Take It Off.
My stage fright holds back me.